Your window on the city.
Cambridge 105.
I quite like baked apples in the winter.
There's no fancy pants stuff in there. It's just proper English pork and it's lovely.
It's just a real sort of hubbub of stuff happening.
Do you remember I bought some chickens?
That's right.
That's when we started to sell eggs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's where it really started.
Yeah, I suppose so, yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you become a butcher?
It was fun. I was at a friend's house once and I was helping her dad cut up a bit of venison. I didn't even know what I was doing, but I just knew I enjoyed it. Now I can do it properly.
We don't stint on the smoked salmon.
Well,
I don't.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, with an hour of food and drink. And thanks to Ian Dayborn for the last 2 hours. I'm Matt Bentman.
And I'm Alan Alder. And today, the great news that there is now a Jack's Gelato ice cream parlour. And we've also found a new source of curries to take home to heat up and eat.
We visit a new mobile coffee provider serving from the back of a Land Rover. We also go to see a really interesting cake maker who uses oriental flavourings. And also find out about a genuine farmhouse bakery.
Pretty interesting. First though, the exciting news that Jack Van Praagh of Jack's Gelato has opened up an ice cream parlour in Bennett Street. I went along to ask him what he was going to be serving up.
At the moment, yeah, the focus is completely on the ice cream. There's nothing else. You know, we will bring in other aspects, some of them ice cream related. You know, we'll have the ice cream cakes. I think we'll start doing that when we're settled in, and we might do coffee, but you know, it is going to be primarily, it's always going to be primarily ice cream.
Right, and are you going to be making the cakes yourself?
We are, yeah. So they'll be ice cream cakes. So we're really looking forward to that, actually. This is another exciting avenue for creativity, and you know, it'll be good fun.
Yeah. Have you got any new flavours coming up this year?
We have been in the kitchen most of the winter working on some new things. We also have a wonderful new machine which will enable us to do flavours with inclusions, which are pieces, and I've kind of come around to that idea as well. Initially I was a little bit kind of prejudiced against them, but we've been playing around with it and just had some really fantastic results. So things such as gingerbread was a really popular one with everyone I tested it with, like a macaron, just kind of smashing those up and putting it through a fior di latte, and a peanut and cornflake cookie, a rhubarb ripple, a apple pie.
So well, tell me about the apple pie. I mean, how does that work? You've got ice cream with...
So we've got fior di latte, which is just a plain milk base, and we churn that, and then when it's done, so beforehand we'd have made a puree with Bramley apples, and so that will be the kind of apple ripple. We'll make some shortcrust pastry, and we'll cook it a little bit more than you would if you were making an apple pie, because you don't want it to absorb too much of the liquid from the ice cream. And then you have the constituent elements of an apple pie. You know, you've got the apples, you've got the pie crust, and then through an ice cream, but in a completely natural way.
Sounds good to me. any others?
We've been working on the sorbets. Pistachio sorbet will definitely be a regular, along with hazelnut sorbet. Not like an everyday regular, but it will be in the rotation, and it's just wonderful. You get that full pistachio flavour, more than you can ever get from an ice cream, because you know the pistachio isn't battling with the dairy on your palate, so you get a kind of, you know, really clean, bold flavour. We do pistachio ice creams as well. It's a different way of enjoying pistachio, and we do pistachio and rose, pistachio and orange flower, a number of different pistachio combinations. But back to the sorbets, blood orange sorbet, clementine sorbet, obviously these are ones that will come out in the autumn, you know. But yeah, lots
right,
of new
so
sorbets
too. You've done a lot of planning ahead. There's not a lot of competition, is there, from high-end ice cream? Why is that?
You know, it's an interesting market. It's especially interesting in Cambridge. You know, there's certainly people that come in here, they look at the flavours, and there's not necessarily things, you know, they're not willing to take that step. You know, they want something that they recognise and they've had before. They don't actually want to, you know, make their experiences better, which I find odd, but it's how it is. It's how it is with a lot of the tourists, and it's It's even how it is with a lot of people that live in a city, so that's okay with us.
Yeah. Now, you've got this churner built in, so that means you're actually going to make ice cream on the premises?
Yes, we have, yesterday arrived from Italy, the Cattabriga FE6B, which without question is the best machine you can get for churning ice cream.
Why? What's different about it?
It just churns it in quite a different way. So it's vertical as opposed to horizontal, and the way the blade configuration is just quite unique, and it will just cut the particles very fine. You get incredibly smooth ice cream, but it will also do it with putting as little air in it as possible, so you get a really dense product. But it just kept it, and yeah, it's beautiful, and it's hypnotic to look at when it's churning in there. You know, you can see it, and it's just, I'm not sure whether it's just me. I've obviously got an incredible fondness for ice cream, but it's beautiful to look at when it's working, and I think it's beautiful to look at when it's not working as well.
Yeah. Do you think your incredible fondness for ice cream will sort of die away, and you'll get bored?
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's a question I ask myself. I mean, I do things to keep myself interested. You know, this parlour, for instance. You know, I mean, every year things change. Every year, you know, we push forward in one aspect or another, and have these new projects and these new avenues. And that's what keeps me interested, as well as my enjoyment of ice cream.
Mm. Are you open or?
We'll be open in about 10 minutes.
Okay, sorry.
But I'm sure it probably, yeah, I don't think I'll be doing this into old age. Yeah, but I like that. I like that it's, you know, it's going to be a moment in time, you know, a 10-year period or something like that, 10, 15 years. Yeah. And then...
And what might follow it? Have you got any thoughts?
I don't. I mean, I had, you know, I've worked in food all my life, but I had, you know, I've already had a kind of step change, I guess, since, you know, I was in restaurants for 10 years, and this is, you know, very different. You know, we work with food, but it's completely different to a restaurant. So I like to, yeah, I imagine it will, I'll stay working in food, but I'd like to move doing, you know, I'd like to move into the charity sector. I don't know, we'll see.
Right, okay. And Jack's Gelato is open from 12 noon until 9 p.m. every day, and it's at 6 Bennett Street.
And there's certainly been some queues as well, haven't there?
Yes, there have. And I'm not surprised that, you know, it is really good. The economics is interesting. Jack was saying, you know, people say, gosh, there's queues outside, you must be doing really well.
Yeah.
But most people only spend about £3, whereas, say, if they go to Steak and Honour up the road, they'll be paying £20.
Mm.
If you go to round the corner to Cambridge Wine Merchants, Jack was saying that when he was working, scooping from the window, it wasn't that unusual for one person to go in and spend £300 on a single bottle of whiskey. So although there's queues outside, there's lots of people, they're not actually spending a lot. So, you know, it's not quite as lucrative as you might guess it was.
Want to catch up with one of your favourite shows or interviews? Listen to a variety of them again on our website. Find out what's best on the food and drink scene in Cambridge with Flavour. Film reviews with Bums on Seats. Or the best of the guests from 105 Daytime. Those and many more are available to download now at cambridge105.fm.
Now, have you ever heard of chiffon cake? This is an alternative to our butter cake varieties, and it's being made locally by a man who is an engineer by day and an award-winning baker by night.
When I moved to this country, I couldn't find this kind of cake. Well, I could find some in Chinatown, but not in Cambridge.
Chiffon cake.
It's quite earthy and delicate.
It's an Eastern-style cake.
I'm very excited about doing this business.
And this is Jin.
Hi, my name is Jin Yichung. I'm baking as The Baking Jin.
That's the name of his website, thebakingjin.com. J-I-N. You come from Borneo, Malaysia?
That's right. There are two parts of Malaysia, East Malaysia and West Malaysia. I think most people know Kuala Lumpur as in the capital of Malaysia, whereas I'm from the east part of Malaysia, which from the Borneo Island.
So describe this chiffon cake.
The chiffon cake is a kind of light textures. In Australia, the people there call it cloud cake. So chiffon cake basically is very fluffy and light sponge, not overly sweet. It's the kind of cake that I grow up with. That's one of the reasons that I started to make mine here.
Now, the chiffon cake, it has this lovely, as you said, a light, cottony texture because it contains no butter.
That's right, it contains no butter. The main ingredient for chiffon cake is sugar, flour, eggs,
whites and yolks,
and vegetable oil, and a bit of flavouring, depending which flavour you like. You can have it, for example, lemon, orange, chocolate. The one I like the most is pandan. Pandan, people are not very familiar over here.
Pandan, P-A-N-D-A-N. It's a tropical tree or shrub that's used widely in Southeast Asian cooking as a flavouring.
Pandan is like Southeast Asian version of vanilla.
Yeah.
We use pandan a lot, not only on dessert and sweets, we also use it in savoury dish. So pandan is very normal there. Surprisingly, it's not very well used over here.
You do pandan cake, which I saw on your website.
Yes.
It's this lovely, almost, not neon, but like a lime green colour. It makes the cake a lime green, and this is because of the screw pine leaves?
Yes, that's the natural colour from the pandan leaves. Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't think we can grow pandan leaves in this country because of the temperature.
Yeah.
But it's so easy to grow back in Malaysia because I think nearly every household, we got a pandan plant in our back garden. So whenever we want to cook something, it's just like the herbs in this country, like parsley, or you can just grow in your garden.
Slow it down a little bit. Box, I think you need to stop.
Just an indication that we are indeed recording outside in Cambridge. We're by the River Cam. All the rowers are just getting in for their evening session. And I also was very intrigued. I saw a photo at the bottom of your webpage, pandan flavour pastries and bakes. I saw what looked like a French croissant with green coloration.
Yes, this is the kind of cooking that I like to do because as a trained scientist or I have a scientific background, I like to experiment a lot with my food.
He works with digital radio, DAB Plus chips specifically. See? Food and radio, they go together well.
The pandan is one example because I love pandan flavours. It has a delicate taste. I think you have to taste it to find it.
One of the things about chiffon cake, I was reading about people who are making it for the first time, for the second, for the third, for the fourth time. In some ways, chiffon cake is prized because it's so easy to fail at making it.
Absolutely.
Like a souffle, you know?
Absolutely.
So there's a satisfaction to be had in making a perfect chiffon cake.
Yes, I totally agree. To be very honest with you, it took me a long time to master chiffon cake. I have a lot of failures. Also depends on the conditions when you bake it, the kind of flour, whether the egg whip up.
Oh yes, the egg whites, they're whipped nice and stiff into firm peaks.
That's the key importance of making a good chiffon cake. And also depends on the type of oven that you use, and the humidity also plays a very big importance, because I did an experiment once. I used the same recipe. I baked it in Cambridge,
yeah.
And used the same recipe in Malaysia, and they came out differently. So I think it's all down to the type of flour, the humidity, oven, because most of the oven here are fan-based.
Yes.
For chiffon cake, there's a little trick. If you use a non-fan oven, it will come out better than a fan oven.
Many chiffon cakes are cooked in a tube-style dish, round with a hole in the middle.
Yes, the tube dish plays a very big part on whether the cake will come out nicely or not, because it introduces the ventilations and the airflow.
I like this quote. A chiffon is as beautiful as a summer's day.
when it is light as air and fluffy like clouds. Which was the first thing you mentioned. It was like clouds.
Yeah. That's why so many people loves it. I'm surprised why it doesn't take off in this country.
Perhaps because in this country we view cakes as something of a treat. Whereas you say on your website, Chinese school children eat it regularly. In Malaysia, people have chiffon cake all day. Every day.
We have it all day. We have it as breakfast, we have it as snacks, we have it as after lunch and in the afternoon. So we have it all day round, around the clock. So because it's so light, you can just have it anytime in Malaysia. Because we prefer chiffon cake than normal butter cake like the Victoria sponge. In our mindset, our definition of cake is healthy.
2 years ago, Jin won the Cambridge Bake Off competition. He made a three-tiered cake, the top layer being chiffon.
I wanted to do chiffon cake for a long, long time. I wanted to see the response of the people when they taste chiffon cake.
Well, you clearly have a tremendous amount of natural skill. Your mother must be so proud because you come over, as you say, not being a natural chef, and yet you won that competition. And now here you are making and selling the cakes as well.
Oh, thank you. I think it's the influence from childhood because it surprised me when I won the competitions and when I start baking, because not in a million years that I thought I would be a baker. Yes, my mom is a very, very good baker. So I watch her bake a lot, but I never bake with her.
Yeah.
That's why when I move over to this country, I don't know why, suddenly I miss her baking so much. So from then on, I started to bake her flavor.
Jin has just handed me this chiffon cake and it is as light as a feather.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Black sesame flavor.
Black sesame flavor. I enjoy that, thanks very much.
You are really welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay. Thanks very much, Jin.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I brought in a piece for you, Alan, which you tried earlier. What did you think?
Well, I just thought it was amazing. I thought the description, cloud cake, was absolutely spot on. It's so light. It's just fantastic. And although the flavour is very delicate, I can see why people eat it all day. It's partly because it's very delicate.
Yes, yeah, completely. And to me, it's got that consistency, like candy floss, but without that sickly sweetness. And it's as light and as fresh now as when Jin gave that to me back on Tuesday. Right. I've been eating it every day since. And it's never got any tougher anything. It's just been spot on all the way. I never had chiffon cake before, but that black sesame flavour was so addictive for me.
Yeah. Does he do any other types?
Yes, he does do many others, all of which you will find on the website. And if you'd like to try those cakes yourself, as well as others he makes, which do include Swiss rolls and wedding cakes, you can find them at thebakinggin.com. That's gin as in J-I-N.
Right, well worth looking up. Mm. Now, the growth in the number of independent brewers has given us lots of good beers, and this is starting to happen more and more with bread too, because of the increase in independent bakeries. What is it with yeast? There's a very popular micro bakery near Cambridge called the White Cottage Bakery, and I spoke with baker Helen Underwood.
All my friends and family were encouraging me to work with food, because they always say work with what you're passionate about, and I've always been passionate about food. My particular passions are bread, butter and cheese. Not so easy to go into the butter or cheese market, but I thought that bread was something that would be ready and easily accessible. Got a large farmhouse kitchen where we are, so I set myself the challenge of making 100 loaves in 100 days just to see whether I would enjoy it. The 100 loaves were done in just a couple of weeks, and by the time I got to 100 days, I'd made thousands of loaves that I would was giving away to so many people.
And were these all the same, or were they different
types?
No.
I was experimenting. But the challenge for me was sourdough, because I'd been a baker, not a professional baker, but I'd been a baker for a long time. I always made my own bread. But sourdough was something I didn't know about, and this was the challenge. It all came down to a very grotty loaf I'd bought in a very upmarket supermarket. I bought this fantastic looking loaf, and I brought it home and cut into it, and a good sourdough loaf will leave you salivating, because that crunch of the crust, and it was a seeded loaf. It was absolutely looked fabulous. And cut into it, buttered it, took a bite, and it was like eating cotton wool. And this was sourdough. It should have been delicious. I knew I could do better. So the 100 loaves in 100 days was to see if I could master sourdough. And it took more than 100 loaves. It took quite a few thousand loaves. But I was making, I would say, within 6 months, pretty darn good sourdough. So at that point, I went out and started to sell to local shops.
Some people, I think, have put off sourdough because it sounds and has the reputation of being strong tasting. And maybe some people misinterpret what strong tasting means. But what would you say to people who haven't tried it?
Well, the word sour is referring to the acid that grows in a natural ferment. And actually, that acid is fantastic stuff. The natural ferment that you use, sometimes referred to as a starter, is just flour and water, but it's got naturally wild yeast inside it that ferment away, and they produce an acidic environment. Now that acid, it's a byproduct, acetic acid and lactic acid.
Lactic acid is the acid in milk, so
absolutely.
People don't need to be worried about the
absolutely
word acid.
Absolutely not. And the great thing about that acid is it sits there just in a very mild form, but it means that the environment is acidic enough to not let bad bacteria grow in that ferment. So you have no bad bacteria growing. What you have are all those acid-friendly bacteria, and they're great. It's fantastic. It's naturally fermented food, which is all the rage at the moment, but we've been making sourdough for years and years and years. This is naturally fermented. It's full of very good bacteria and this naturally occurring acid, which is very, very mild. You can have, I sell them myself, different kinds of sourdough. I only sell one sour, which is my five-seed sour. And I deliberately use an old ferment for that to make a slightly more acidic taste. But if you've got very young sourdough that you use, that you freshen the night before, it's probably only 8 to 12 hours old, you can barely taste the acidity. It's just very, very light and mild. It just gives you a natural leaven.
Tell us about what breads you've made this week.
Oh, right. So I have a sort of a regular client base these days. I sell to about five shops and a couple of restaurants. We make on a regular basis our rustic whites, which use white wheat and some wholemeal spelt, one of my favourite flours to work with. We make 100% spelt, wholemeal spelt. We'll make 100% rye, and in fact, I make three different kinds of rye. There's quite a big market for good Scandinavian and sort of Germanic breads, those rye breads in the local area. I make a plain rye, 100% rye. I make a seeded rye, and then I've got a new Scandinavian wild rye, which is a very dark rye, very flavoursome, which is proving very popular. I make my seeded sour. I make a malted four grain. We've won quite a few awards, actually, with our various loaves that we make. That four grain won a World Bread Award. The rustic white we have won a gold at the World Bread Awards last year. The seeded one has a wonderful Great Taste Award as well. So we've done reasonably well on the awards front. We make wonderful raisin loaves, which are great for weekend breads. So those are all the sourdoughs that we make, but we also make Cambridge buns, our take on Chelsea buns, all butter, whole cane sugar, and we soak our dried fruit in chai so that we have some spices in there as well to make a delicious, all-natural Cambridge bun.
Very good. I know that you experiment, and that's partly how you have such a wide variety of breads. What would you say your top success has been in your experimentation?
What I'd like to do is to take whatever's seasonal and incorporate that, and whatever's local, because we use a local flour. The grain that we use is milled locally at Swaffham Prior, but is grown literally in the fields around our village, because we border the Wimpole estate, which is great, low food miles, fantastic stuff. But then we like to take any local ingredients that we can. So recently, this weekend just been, I was out foraging for wild garlic. So we'll incorporate wild garlic, either chopped in our loaves or made into pesto and incorporated in the loaves in swirls in pesto. But we can use different herbs from our cottage garden. We'll use beetroot, make fantastic pink beetroot bread. We can use squashes in the autumn and make... Somebody in Grantchester said that their garden was overrun with wild leek, so they gave me a big bag full. I found a big bag full on my doorstep of wild leek. So we turned that into wild leek and potato bread, where we roasted the potatoes and used that.
Yeah. Have you had any failures?
Oh, never worry about failures. Yes, absolutely. Ingredient-wise, not so much. I don't think there's been any ingredients that have gone terribly wrong, but bread failures can happen all the time. It happens to the best of us. The classic in the bread world is to forget the salt. So you're waiting for your gluten to develop, and you're mixing. And of course, you can leave it in a mixer, and you think it's not there yet. And then before you know it, it's overworked because you forgot the salt. So yes, that can happen. And once you've overworked that dough completely, there's nothing much you can do. With most bread, I always say you can do pretty much anything to bread, and it'll be wonderfully edible because it's home baked and it's going to taste delicious even if it's not perfect. But the one thing you can't do is overproof. So if you have overproofed your bread, and I have done that, where I have just forgotten loaves.
Overproofing would be leaving it for too long put it in the oven.
The yeast has just given up. And what happens then is if you press your dough very gently, you'll find that the indent you've made doesn't bounce back, because the yeast has basically, it's blown your loaf into this fantastic looking balloon of a loaf, but there's nothing left once it goes into the oven, and it will collapse. It'll be like a collapsed cake.
And you run bread making classes as well.
That's right, yes. We have an artisan bread school. So we open up the bakery once or twice a month. We sort of have plans to extend that probably next year to run more classes. But at the moment we run workshops probably twice a month. And we have classes in sourdough bread making. We do an introductory class for people who've never done any bread making before at all. We do classes in French bread making to show people how to make and shape baguettes and other French breads. And we run an Italian course where we'll look at making Italian breads, ciabatta and pane all'olio and focaccia, where we will take all sorts of seasonal ingredients and incorporate those into our breads as well. Again, the wild garlic went down a storm in our Italian course because we made pesto to incorporate into our pane all'olio.
Oh, it sounds fantastic. Thanks very much, Helen.
Helen Underwood of the White Cottage Bakery. Now, you've had her bread, Alan.
Yes, I have. I had a malted loaf, a really dark rye to go with it, and also a Cambridge bun, and they were very good. They looked good and they tasted good too, unlike the one Helen bought, which started her off on baking.
And where can you buy it?
Well, the nearest to Cambridge is the larder at Burwash Manor. There's also Country Kitchen in Haslingfield, Toft Shop in Toft, Nibs Butchers and Deli in Bourne, and Woodview Farm Shop in Gamlingay. And if you have a meal at the Three Horseshoes in Maddingley, you'll find her breads there as well.
And that music signals time for the latest food tweets from the city.
The Wandering Yak is at Stir in Chesterton Road tonight. And on the 28th of this month, Thirsty has a beer garden by the Museum of Technology, actually opposite the Chesterton Foot and Cycle Bridge. There'll be food trucks, beer, wine and stuff like that. 28th to the 30th of April, and it's called Thirsty Riverside. Right, curry. There's a new source of curry in Cambridge. Neera Saini of the Derby Stores in Newnham has started selling her homemade curries at the shop. And I asked her last weekend what curries were always in stock.
I always have either chicken tikka, chicken korma, or butter chicken. These three are very mild ones. And then I have normal chicken curry, normal lamb curry, and then loads of vegetarian ones as well. But
right. Well, and what sort of vegetables are in the vegetarian ones?
Vegetable, aubergine, potato are really, really popular. spinach and potatoes, and then sometime I put paneer in spinach. That's good as well. And I even, for the first time in my life, I did sprouted mung beans, which I did myself, and I added paneer to them, and people really loved it.
And your origins are from the Punjab.
Punjab, yeah.
Yeah.
Punjab.
So is what you're making, does it reflect
most
Punjabi?
Of it Punjabi style. Yeah, it's Punjabi style. And I keep on trying different recipes, different things.
Yeah. And always Punjabi style?
Always Punjabi style, yeah.
Right, so what's the characteristic of Punjabi food? Are there particular spices which are popular in Punjab?
So nothing that they use much like coconut milk, or they don't add too much of sweetness into their food.
Right, and like what sorts of spices are in there usually then?
My main ingredients are cumin, coriander. I use quite a lot fenugreek. Seeds or leaves, they are very, very good flavour to add into any food.
And where does the heat come from then? Is from
chilies.
Yeah.
That's just from the green chilies. Right. I only use green chili. I never use powdered chili, no paprika, nothing. Just pure green chili. Just grind them and just use my own ground garlic, ginger. Only thing I buy that's ready-made is like turmeric. Everything else, I don't use any ready-made masalas or ready-made paste, nothing.
And how hot are they? You said things like the butter chicken are quite mild. But
very mild, because you don't do no chili in them.
Right, so what's the hottest one that you do, would you say?
I try not to do too hot, because people here, first week, you need to find out your market, how hot people like it. And people here are not ready for that much heat, so I keep it at medium heat. That way you can taste the food rather than just the chilies and burning your mouth.
And in Punjab, there's quite a lot of wheat grown, isn't there, as opposed to rice.
Yeah, right.
So does that mean that there's good Punjabi breads?
So we do enough chapatis, naans, bhaturas, that's right, pre-packed, you can buy. And we sell them in the shop.
And bhaturas are probably not as well known as chapatis. And
bhaturas are fried chapatis, really. It's like leavened flour, you dough, and then you deep fry it. Fresh, they're really, really tasty. But
right. Okay, so how's it going? You've been doing this for what, 3 weeks?
3 weeks, right. And first week was crazy. I would never, ever, ever imagined that they'd be so popular. But now, because people are away, lots of people are away. Normally, our shop is like so quiet, but because of the curries, it's keep on coming. It really has made so much difference.
And is there a particular favourite? Is there one that's particularly selling?
I think everything seems to go.
Well, what's your favourite of the things that you've got on sale?
I love chickpeas. I can eat chickpeas every day.
Right,
I love
chickpeas. So they're one of the dishes then?
Chickpeas are, yeah, we have sell chickpeas. And they're very good as well, because they're like protein and quite wholesome, and they fill you up.
Can you tell us how much they are? How much you?
All the dals start at 3.50 a portion. All the other vegetables, they are 4.99. And meats are $5.99, apart from lamb. When I have lamb meat, that's $6.99. But if I make minced lamb, or I made koftas, lamb kofta curry, that's quite good as well. That's been very popular. And that's $5.99 as well.
Right, and that's a good portion.
And the sauces are really thick as well, so that fills you up as well.
Great. Okay, thank you very much, Neera.
And that was Neera from the Derby Stores in Derby Street, Newnham. And food writer and Fitzbillies co-owner Tim Hayward discovered the curries during the week and was very enthusiastic about them indeed on Twitter. And I can tell you that they are good. And Neera will be back after the next item with a very simple recipe for you. So simple that it takes 13 seconds to describe.
Now, the street food scene is doing very well in Cambridge. Shops around the city are benefiting from partnering up with a vendor of an evening to host an on-the-spot venue for food and drink. Now, one of the latest entrants to the scene is the Rural Coffee Project, and I caught up with them recently at a few food park events.
we were travelling along and we had that same conversation again. Come on, we know we want to work together. What do we want to do? And Hannah said, I want a cafe. What do you want in life? And I jokingly said, a Land Rover Defender. And Hannah said, no, we're a bit, seriously, like, what do you want to do? And I said, oh, hang on a minute. What if we put your passion for a cafe and my desperate need for a Land Rover Defender? Please, Hannah, let me have a Land Rover Defender. I do care about coffee, don't worry.
This is Andy and Hannah Clark and their sheepdog, Bella. They run the Rural Coffee Project, which is one of the latest street food vans to appear in Cambridge. Except it's not a van, it's a big old Land Rover.
Daisy the truck is a Land Rover 127, manufactured in 1990.
Yeah, well, she was owned by the RAF, a mobile drone and missile testing centre, or a command station. So she was full of computers that flew drones and missiles. So as a bit of tongue-in-cheek, sometimes we say, to make tea, not war.
No! Wait!
What is it? Do you want a cup of tea?
That's a passion of mine as well, because I actually studied nutrition at university, of which I did my dissertation in tea. So there is background. This is today's special. Although we're called the Rural Coffee Project, simply because coffee sells better than tea, we have an equally good quality set of teas, 12 different teas that we offer, all loose leaf teas in tea gems. So that is proper loose leaf tea, individually portioned and put into a silk bag so that it's not floating around in your car. By a company called Candula, who are also very local. Mm. She lives in Wilburton. She keeps in regular contact with us, and we chat and have a laugh about tea and coffee and working in this industry.
You must drink our tea.
This is our special on today. Mm-hmm. This is mint, Moroccan mint, which we grow at home. So I suppose not quite Moroccan, but
unless you commute from Morocco every day.
Yeah, but not quite. I'd love. Yeah, with Candula green tea, which is Ceylon green tea. And there's a bit of sugar in there as well, because that's what the Moroccans do. If you've ever been there and had their tea, it's quite sweet. We've gone for a halfway house because we want to help people maintain their teeth in their mouth rather than, you know.
Right, I'll put the kettle on then.
So, yeah, what do you think?
This is lovely.
This is lovely and smooth, very relaxing, instantly calming. That's what springs to mind there.
Yeah, the idea of this is to be a very fresh drink in the summer. You know, this is a very high quality green tea, so you've got a lot of antioxidants and everything in there, very refreshing. Small amount of caffeine, there is a bit of caffeine in green tea, but not too much. And then you've got that fresh mint in there as well, which gives that really fresh flavour. And then we've managed to join Food Park and offer good quality hot drinks here for not only the customers, but the traders as well.
Andy, can I get another one of them chai lattes?
Yeah.
Please, mate.
Food Park.
Yeah. Charlie.
This is Charlie Mackay-Rethoff. She runs it.
I always say every week I'm not going to eat any food this week. Every day I eat something because it's that good. So, yeah.
Two hot chocolates and three burgers and two curries and,
yeah. And that's just a Wednesday. That's just a Wednesday lunchtime. So, yeah, it's great.
Cheers, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie.
And so it's really kicked off better than we thought. However, I think a lot of that is due to passion and hard work. It doesn't just happen. Yeah. It's literally 7 day a week lifestyle for us at the moment. You throw everything into it.
Also, we're flying without a navigational system and can't seem to change course.
Miss, are you telling us absolutely everything?
Not exactly. We're also out of coffee.
Now, you're called the Rural Coffee Project, and your menu says that your blend is locally roasted.
It's with a great small company called Sidewalk, who've just opened a cafe in Caldecott, and they have their roastery on location there. And we're their only trade suppliers, so we actually use their special CB23 blend, which we developed with them, which is a mixture between a Brazilian Arabica and a Vietnamese Robusta, which we find works brilliantly with our coffee machine. It seems to be a massive hit. Our customers seem to love it and keep coming back for more.
Time for a quick coffee lesson. Hannah mentioned Arabica and Robusta beans. Now, roughly speaking, the best coffees are all Arabicas, and the highest quality blends are pure Arabica ones. They have a sweeter, softer taste with tones of sugar, fruit, and berries. They live in the subtropics on high slopes, so they're hand-picked because large machine pickers can't get to them.
I'll be back.
Robusta, again, generally speaking, has a harsher flavour with a grain-like overtone and a peanutty aftertaste. As the name suggests, Robusta is more robust. It's hardier to disease, it can be grown on the plains.
How soon can you land? I can't tell. You can tell me, I'm a doctor.
Not those type of plains.
and can be machine harvested, making the picking faster and cheaper. Now, Robusta does not necessarily mean worse. These days, some speciality Robustas are matching speciality Arabicas for quality. Robustas also contain twice the caffeine, giving you that hit in the morning. Hannah and Andy's CB23 blend is 80% Brazilian single-origin Arabica and 20% Vietnamese Robusta.
We get quite a lot of positive feedback on the blend because what we did when we developed it, rather than go for something fashionable, something that's sort of hip to go for at the moment, we've just tried a load of coffees, blended them with the samples that we got, and just said to people, what do you like the taste of?
Yeah.
We were quite determined at the beginning of that we would go on taste and not on fashion or anything like that. People say that our coffee is one of the only coffees that they have without sugar because it's actually sweet enough, not too bitter, not too acidic. It's actually sweet enough to drink without sugar, so people really like that.
Watch out for innuendo when you're talking coffee.
So I guess a quick steam and a grind. Maybe.
A quick steam and grind. This man knows what he wants. I haven't got any beans in there now.
Four seasons in one day.
This job is heaven in summer and hell in winter. And people always say to us, oh, coffee, oh, it's a cold day. That must be your best days. But actually, no, it's not. Nice weather, people sitting outside, that's when people drink tea and coffee. So
this winter we've had Storm Doris, which was a bit of a mission for us. We had a day and it was -4 all day. And we found that the milk was actually freezing outside, so we just had to stop trading. It's all coming with experience, but hopefully the winter's over and we're just going to have a really nice spring and summer ahead of us. Bring it on.
Sometimes we can go to an event and really not make any money at all, but you come away having really made a difference in somebody's life. So that's quite important to us as well. We need the balance of the two.
Doing a variety of different weekday pitches and events, I think, keeps the job really interesting, and it means that we get to go to all sorts of different places and meet all sorts of different people, which is something which we both really, really love about this job.
When the steam comes out, will it hurt us? Will the steam hurt us?
It will if it gets on. Yeah.
Today we had a selection of homemade date flapjacks and double chocolate brownies, which we cooked this morning. Every morning we try and bake as freshly as we can.
You know, that rural farmhouse, rustic sort of cake.
We actually find that our busiest period is when everyone's had their food. So we definitely get a later rush compared to everyone else, which is nice. We can pace ourselves and get caffeined up ourselves.
No power steering on this vehicle. There goes Steak and Honour, pulling away from Food Park.
I was fascinated with the Rural Coffee Project's navy blue Land Rover coffee hut. Maybe it's because seeing all the street food vans in the city, you know, many of them, such as Steak and Honour's vans, Azahar, and Frank and Ling Ling Ponan's vehicles, they're all converted Citroën H panel vans, which is fine. It's just nice to hear that roar of a Land Rover amongst them. Andy's even refurbished his dad's old trailer to go with it.
That was built by my dad probably about 5 years before I was born.
Which carries all the food and the coffees.
Like four seasons in one day.
Sadly, my dad got very ill with pancreatic cancer and we had 16 months of being in hospital. He passed away last year. This was sat in the garage and I thought, we painted it the colours of the truck, renovated all the wood and all the prop stands so it can stand up and be a display stand for our cakes and things. And yes, some people like the trailer better than they do the Land Rover.
Before all this, Hannah was working in retail and Andy was doing personal training, boot camps and the like across Cambridge. This is their first venture into the food scene, and they've ploughed everything into it.
My sister said to me, would you rather look back in years to come? You've got three things you could say. Well, hey, it worked. Or, oh, well, I tried it, but it didn't work. Or, what if I tried it? And for me, the what if was the only answer that I didn't really want to have to deal with. So I thought, well, there's only one way to do it. Let's go for it. Let's give it a go. The reason that we've done the Rural Coffee Project in the way that we have is because it is us. It is true to who we are. We are outdoorsy, rural people, and although we enjoy going into the city and experiencing all that, we always like to come back to the more rural areas. So.
coffee, cakes, flapjacks, tea, and a sheepdog. Oh, and a reference to my dodgy radio editing.
Touch my Land Rover and die.
You probably said that anyway.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
Andy and Hannah Clark, it's been lovely to speak to you.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. Crumbling like pastries,
and they scream the worst things in life come free. And you can find out more about Andy and Hannah's venture and where they'll be appearing next from their website, ruralcoffeeproject.co.uk, or via their Twitter feed at ruralcoffeeproj.
Find out what's happening in Cambridge over the next 7 days on our website.
The Cambridge 105 What's On Guide opens up a window on our city, giving you ideas of where to spend your free time with friends, family, or the kids. Check it out now at cambridge105.fm.
And back to Curry's. And as promised, here's Neera from the Derby Stores in Newnham with a spectacularly simple recipe.
Put a few fenugreek seeds in a thingy. In oil and put potatoes in and put cauliflower in, and it has got really nice flavour. You don't need anything
else. Just as simple
as
that.
Just as simple as that.
Right.
Yeah, that doesn't sound too challenging. So why not give it a go? And from making your own to growing your own, Alan?
Yes, well, we had some very warm weather last weekend, 25 degrees, and it's been a bit chillier this week. But I asked Dave Fox of Trumpington Allotments for what tips he has this month, and he began by telling me that you can pick up some pretty cheap fruit trees from garden centres at the moment because we're at the end of the best time for planting them. And he was about to plant an apple tree, which he'd got mail order.
It's just arrived in the post. Very late, actually. One normally wouldn't plant bare root trees this far into the spring. The weather's a little bit too hot and dry, really, for putting bare rooted plants in.
Well, you've dug quite a big hole for it.
Absolutely, yeah. And I don't know how big the root system on this is yet, so I've probably overdug the hole, but there's no harm doing that. And what we want to do is create a nice large area with nutritious planting mix in it, which the roots can grow into and get established.
Right.
So I'm just about to make that planting mix. The first thing to go into the hole. A few bones. It's an amazing number of bones you dig up on allotments. I don't know where they come from, whether it's previous allotment holders who've been putting bones in, or whether it's
not the allotment holders themselves then.
I thought of that. Well, if that is a previous tenant of my plot, I think he was extremely well built, although if that's a femur, it's a very short one.
Yes, it is, isn't it?
I don't think they're human.
Yes, I wonder if it's like a monk jack or something like that.
Ooh. In the wheelbarrow, where I've dug out some of the topsoil that I dug out from the hole, I'm adding some manure to the topsoil. Just chop that in a bit. And then mix it up. By the way, while we're doing this, we're also looking out for roots of perennial weeds. Because, you know, obviously once the tree is established, we don't want to dig into there and to get perennial weeds out, because we don't want to disturb the root system of the tree. So this is our last chance, really.
Yeah.
And then, if that's not enough, here's some compost. And this is hopefully some. Oh, look at that.
Yes. Oh, that does look good.
Oh, that doesn't look brilliant, doesn't it? Cool. So this is from my old compost bin. Just finished digging it out. But look, this is a moisture-rich, nutrient-rich, terrific. Oh, God, it's just lovely, isn't it?
Mm.
So we're going to put some of that into the hole on top of the bones. And the roots are going to be spread out over the top of that. So with bare root trees, stake first, then tree. Obviously, we don't want to cover the roots up and then put the stake in and break some of the roots we've just planted. So the stake's going to go in just on the south side of the hole, because we're going to want that in on the windward side of the tree. Not a long stake, it's just going to support the base of the tree for the first few years. So yeah, I've just taken the tree out of the bag. I'm going to try and get the roots into the hole quite quickly. We don't want them to dry out. And I'm aiming to get the grafting point just at about level, at the height of level ground when I fill the hole up. And what you need to do for that is find something flat. Yeah, we're good. So now we've got the horizontal handle of the spade across the hole, level with the pretty much the grafting point, which is where the tree was planted before. So that's where we're going to be. So
And now I'm going to shovel the rest of the planting mix in around the roots.
So now that I'm happy the roots are reasonably well covered, the rest of the planting mix can go in one job lot. And I'm just going to gently tamp down with my foot, not really compacting it, but just making sure that the soil gets consolidated around the roots before I shovel in the rest of the topsoil from around the side of the hole. So then the last thing to do before the water, one more thing to do before the water, is to tie the stake to the tree.
What's happening here, Dave? We've got some trenches.
Yes, so we're planting asparagus, which arrived in the post today, and very inconveniently at the same time as the tree that we just planted, so it's been a busy day. Asparagus is another perennial crop. It might be good for 20 years. In general, I'm just trying to grow a few more perennials. They're less work overall, because they're more resilient to extreme weather, and we seem to be having more extreme weather, and I seem to be having less energy as I get old. So both those factors suggest perennials are good.
Yes, asparagus is also quite costly as well, if that's an issue for anybody.
It is indeed, and it's also a really useful vegetable because it fills that gap, doesn't it? I mean, there's not a lot else that's coming in April, really. Certainly not something that's sweet and succulent and special, something that can really, really make a meal stand out. Yeah. So, as I say, these plants arrived in the post today, the bag, and what we're looking at is, and it's got a nice little white tip, and that's the growing point, and then a good dozen or so roots, a little like an octopus, but more, with more than eight roots. So we're going to go to the trench that I've already prepared, quite deep and quite wide, and a little mound at the bottom of the.
So it's about a foot deep.
Almost, about a foot wide. Asparagus likes to be in free draining soil. It's not going to do quite so well in clay, and that's why the advice is to plant it in this fashion on a tiny mound at the bottom of a trench, and then arrange the roots to sort of go down, and they have the growing tip on the top of the mound. The roots are quite delicate, so I'm going to use the sieve to put some nice weed free and stone free soil. There, we're done.
So you've covered it just to the tip.
I've covered it just so that white tip is pointing through. So, and then the method from now on is to, as the new shoot grows upwards, then we earth it up by sieving more soil into the hole, just gently to build some soil. And that, by the way, that's another chance to remove the perennial weeds from it, because again, this is a crop that's going to be established here for 20 years, and we're never going to be able to dig it up to remove bindweed and dandelions and so on. So,
when do you get your first crop? About 3 years, did you say?
You can pick some young a few shoots maybe after 2 years, but it's why not wait, let the plant get strong. The reason you don't pick too much is just to let the plant get good and strong.
And jobs to be done?
Well, apart from tending to the perennials and planting new ones, of course, it's warm, it's spring's in full flow, so it's time to sow and plant pretty much everything, really. So potatoes, beans, peas, salad crops, start off seedlings of brassicas to plant out in early summer, and tomatoes, of course, and don't forget the kirkibits, the pumpkins and squashes, and almost everything, actually. So,
right.
So get going. If you haven't sown anything yet, now is time. Otherwise, you will be racing to the garden centre and spending a lot of money at the end of May.
Thank you very much.
And that was Dave Fox there from Trumpington Allotments. And on to our news section, beginning with jobs. Alan?
Yes, jobs. Hot numbers in Gwydir Street and Trumpington Street is looking for a kitchen assistant and a front of house. Experience is preferred, but training will be given. Apply with a CV and covering letter explaining why you want to work at Hot Numbers and what makes you suitable, plus number of hours you're looking for, and send it to info@hotnumberscoffee.co.uk.
The Cambridge Cookery School and Cafe is looking for a full-time chef with some experience and a willingness to learn. So, phone Cambridge 247 620 for details.
To Tomorrow at Cambridge's Sunday Market, many food stalls will still be there, even though it's Easter Sunday. Amongst those that will are Simon Steele's Vegetables, Hawthorne Farms Pork, Chicken and Eggs, and Wild Country Organics. And amongst those not there are K Colombian Coffee, Azahar's Spanish Food, and Cam Cattle. And nice to see the cattle back on Cambridge's Commons, by the way.
Yeah. A new Cambridge bakery opened yesterday in Chesterton Road. It's called Stir, and it's next to the Stir Cafe.
And Honest Burgers opens today in Wheeler Street, adding mightily to the competition for meat eaters in that area.
And at the Cambridge Cookery School, on Friday the 21st of April, is Sussex Vineyards Fox and Fox owner and winemaker Jonica Fox. And she'll be presenting her wines along with a five-course spring menu.
A week on Sunday, the 23rd of April, is St. George's Day. St. George, who was actually from Turkey, is also the patron saint of Aragon in Spain. And you can celebrate the day from 1 p.m. at Cambridge Wine Merchants in Cherry Hinton Road. Five tapas from K Rico Tapas and five wines for £32.50. Booking is essential. Email cherry@cambridgewine.com.
The same venue has a South African wine tasting on the 24th of April. Starts at 7 for a 7:30 p.m. start. £20 for the wine and nibbles. Again, email cherry@cambridgewine.com.
The dates for this year's Food Park Night Markets have been announced. They're the 27th of May, 22nd of July and 30th of September, all at Gravel Hill Farm off Maddingley Road, all from 5 till 10 p.m. Admission is £4 for adults and free for children. There's street food, wine, beer, cocktails, music, somewhere to sit down, everything. And that's all we have time for today. If you missed bits or just want to hear the whole thing all over again, the podcast is early next week.
And remember, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.fm, or follow us on Twitter at flavour105. And of course, you can follow the Cambridge 105 radio at Cambridge 105.
You can indeed. We'll be back on the 29th, but until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.